Hi, everyone. Welcome to a special edition of Mentioned in Dispatches. We seem to pop up with a random regular summer edition these days. Coming back to us for a second summer in a row, Rex Brynan is joining us from up there north of the wall. Rex, how are you?
I'm fine.
Rex is actually going to have to bail out midway through this podcast. The zombie apocalypse is calling or something to that effect, right?
Yeah, it takes some while to prepare for it. So.
Yes. So we're going to lose Rex partway through, but I'm sure he'll have twice as much goodness in half the time. Also, from left to right on your podcast dial, we have joining us a pair of podcast rookies. Yuna Wong is here joining us. So welcome, Yuna. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Appreciate you guys making the time. And not just podcast rookie, but a podcast rookie from over the pond. Sally, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
We've gathered these three here together because they all exist in the world of professional wargaming, which you know we've covered quite a bit here on Mentioned in Dispatches. We've got them here today, these three here today, because they were all part of a special initiative that we're going to let them introduce here real quick. But just a blanket statement, we've done this in the past on occasion, but we want to make sure that we do mention it. All three of these folks all belong to professional wargaming organizations, but they are here talking for themselves. They're not representing any sort of official position of any of these agencies or organizations. They're just here to offer their thoughts on their experiences within this professional wargaming realm, and especially on the topic we're about to dig into. And that topic is, as announced on PAX Sims and a couple of other places, there's a new set of principles, the Darby House Principles. That's the official title, right, Rex?
That's right.
Yeah, so the Darby House Principles are seeking to address some issues on diversity and inclusion in the professional wargaming ranks. So, Rex, can you give us the thumbnail précis of sort of where what these entail and why now?
Well, I think this is something that professionals have been talking about for a while. There was a panel discussion, for example, at the last Connections North conference in Montreal, about making sure that our games are inclusive, that we're mobilizing all talent, that no one feels any barriers to getting into our games. We recognize that diversity is an advantage when you're doing serious games for analytical and other purposes. And we had decided, partly because some of the online treatment that UNA had received, that we needed to put these to a statement of principles. So we put together an ad hoc committee, and we came up with some wording, and we put the wording out there, and now it's been endorsed by almost all of the Connections professional wargaming groups, by the Serious Games Network in France, which is the French equivalent, by DSTL, which is the research and development branch, essentially, of the UK Ministry of Defense, a bunch of other organizations, and we've been really happy with the response to it.
These principles on diversity and inclusion, we're going to link them here on the podcast, so we're not going to try and read them to everybody, right? We trust that our audience can click and read what's there. But these things are fairly new, and as I recall, they are explicitly targeted at the professional wargaming ranks, right? This isn't something that, look, inevitably, and we all know which Facebook groups we're talking about, there's this caveman reactionary reflex that says, damn it, you're not going to tell me what to do. But those are the hobby gamists, right? Those aren't the professionals that we're talking about and targeting these things.
I mean, I think that this is a controversial issue in a minority of the hobby wargaming community, which is, let's face it, 98% male, according to surveys. Amongst professionals, we're up around 15-20% female, and of course, there are other underrepresented groups as well. At university, frankly, we get about half-half in courses. I think overwhelmingly, the response from people who wargame for a living, for analytical or educational or training purposes, has been positive. They view this as common sense. I think there are some people in the hobby who think we're going to go into their basements and force members of underrepresented groups into their games, but that's all a bit silly.
Yeah, I think folks who understand nuance and generally think as adults would come to that same conclusion. And yet, sadly, that doesn't always seem to be the case. Rex, you had mentioned, in part due to some of the online treatment that Yuna, among others, had received. Yuna, without trying to, like, you know, pick a scab off or anything too much. Can you give the audience a quick sense of some of that treatment, where it was seen, and kind of what happened there?
Sure. You know, and you're right that we're talking about professional wargamers and not hobby wargamers, but where there is sort of salience is oftentimes the professional wargaming crowd encourages newcomers to wargaming to learn from the commercial, from the hobby wargaming crowd, right? But the hobby wargaming crowd is so toxic that you cannot in good conscience tell women interested in professional gaming that they should go into this toxic, you know, sort of this toxic pool, right? And by toxic pool, and again, right, it's not just to, you know, Facebook can be a toxic pool of anything, right? But it's like in those hobby gaming groups, I can post an innocuous, something innocuous about how I like this game, and then within minutes, right, someone will post suggesting that I should have sex with him, and then we'll get mad when I say, you know, no thanks to sexual harassment, and then I'll post the Oxford Dictionary definition of sexual harassment, and then he'll get angry, and the moderators won't do anything, right?
Yeah.
And then we'll put up pictures or, you know, like, I think one time there were, like, miniatures of prostitutes, right? Or, you know, just the sort of the... Sometimes the images that were where it sort of, even though they're sort of plastic images, right, it's the leering, right? And then if I express discomfort with that and say that's sexist, I'm told by all these men it's not sexist. They remove the moderator removes my post and says sexism has nothing to do with wargaming, right? And then women leave because of that. And then so I try to make my case. I say it's like the constant little things that add up. And then someone will respond with the post and said, I looked through her background and, you know, so accusing me of being a wild-eyed feminist who no one would want to sleep with, right? So this idea again and again that sort of women who say something are sexually unattractive, right? That's the worst insult I guess a man could give to a woman. So that's problematic, especially if you want to mentor women in professional wargaming. If some of these resources or places where people who are men have traditionally gone for ideas and for community, like just... it's just not something you can recommend. So that's one, right? So that's why there's still salience. And then, for example, so recently I became co-director for the Center for Gaming at RAND Corporation. And then RAND tweeted out some of a picture of me and some of my work. And then I was attacked for being an infiltrator from the Chinese government.
So
right now, unfortunately, the United States is swinging back to a time where sort of the anti-Chinese sort of racism is really back in full force. I could go into that again. So it's like, it's great. So I'm being targeted for both being a woman and for both being Asian. So it that is problematic, but it isn't just the online treatment. I think in a lot of subtle and really not so subtle ways, it's just harder to be included. I go to a professional wargaming conference, right? This is after I co-led the wargaming effort that supported the 2018 U.S. National Defense Strategy, and I co-led the gaming effort that stress-tested the 2019 NATO military strategy, which is NATO's first military strategy ever. And then someone will say hi and then assume I don't know anything and explain to me that Germany and the Soviet Union had a non-aggression pact in World War II. And then, I'll go up because I'm one of the speakers. I say, for the love of God, don't mansplain like women who show up to the conference. Right? And the person is really shocked and goes, I hope I didn't do that. I'm like, I have 5 degrees. I might have known that, right? Like, you would not say, like, if there was a middle-aged male, white male, kind of graying who had, had the professional background like that, you wouldn't go up to him and go, well, that Germany and the Soviet Union had a non-aggression pact in World War II. Like, just the level of mansplaining also can be frustrating.
I get on projects explained to me all the time. It's maddening.
I think part of what's so disheartening in all of that, that the way you're explaining it, quite frankly, I've seen a ton of just outright idiotic crap from all kinds of different directions show up on social media. What's painful in all of that is a lot of times people want to sort of blow off some of the social media backlash as that anonymity or that physical distance that allows people to sort of be turds online. You know, the excuse is always, well, they wouldn't behave like that in real life. And yet you've got examples of that happening in real life where it happens in person also, which just seems absolutely nuts. It's ridiculous to sort of hear some of those things. Sally, you were chiming in there. I'm sure you've got some other similar war stories. Do you have one or two that stick out in your mind that you'd want to share?
Well, so much of it isn't overtly horrible. It's just people being clueless and oblivious. So my favorite story is, after having given a lecture about Watu and Dalby House and the Wrens and the work they did, a guy came up to me and he's like, oh, this is great. I'm so glad you're telling these stories. We need to hear more about these women's stories. And I'm like, you know why people don't hear this so often? It's because men silence women when they try to speak up. And he literally cut me off to say, no, it's because women don't tell each other their own stories.
What?
And I didn't know whether to laugh or cry, but that's the kind of microaggressions that you're putting up with all the time in a male-dominated space.
Yeah, and that's, I'll tell you, so when the Origins Online blow-up happened, three-ish weeks ago as we are recording this. Lord knows how long it will have been by the time people get around to listening. But right around the end of May, early June, so for a little bit of background context, depending on when people are listening to this, Origins, most of the major summer conventions here in North America, as a result of the plague currently going about, they just canceled their conventions. They said, nope, sorry, we're going to try again next year. Origins had actually kicked the can down the road a little bit and said, we're going to move the physical, the in-person convention dates to October, and instead we're going to do an online one on the weekend of the original dates, and we're going to move this down the line. And now, since then, they've canceled both the online one and the in-person one in October. But the online one, in large part, was canceled when a lot of creators and journalists and guest speakers all pulled out over some indelicacies, I guess, or some lack of things that were done by Gamma. And that, quite frankly, that's a whole separate show in and of itself. But in the discussions that came out around a lot of those people walking away, one particular anecdote really jumped out at me. It was one of the women who was a game designer who was going to be a guest on one of the panels at Origins Online. And what jumped out at me, that, you know, right up against the Dalby House principles, is really what sort of made me pay attention to it all. She was talking about the fact that she goes to Zumba classes at her local gym, or she did before the plague sort of shut it all down. So she was going to these Zumba classes, and it was always all women in the Zumba class. And every now and then, they'd get a guy show up for the class. And the guy would show up for one class, and he would never come back again. It wasn't an overt thing of anybody looking at this guy and going, hey, get out of here, or overly sexualizing him, or anything else. It was just, he was the only dude in the room, and nobody really seemed to go out of their way to say, hey, welcome, glad you're here, thanks for being here, you know, hope to see you again next time, or any of those things. It was that the guy kind of figured out by himself, hey, I'm the only dude here, this doesn't look like some place for me, and walked away. And wondering if that sort of similar, she was using that as an exemplar of how she has felt in many tabletop gaming environments, and I didn't know if a similar thing applied to you guys in the professional wargaming environments. Sally, that's sort of close to some of the stories you were just telling. Is that kind of a similar feel to what you've dealt with?
I certainly feel like I have to defend my space more aggressively as the only woman in the room. So that there'll be situations where if there's a man in the room, I'm assumed subordinate, even though it's my project, or even if I know more about this subject than the other people. But it's not as aggressive like that in the workplace as it would be on the internet.
How often have you been the only woman in the room in the professional gaming settings that you've been in?
Yeah, almost all the time. I mean, the most diverse war game I've ever played was when we recreated the Watu game in the original bunker in Liverpool, and I had to work so hard to get a 50-50 gender split. I would say, I want women for this war game, and the men would be trampling down the door, and I'd have to be like, stop, this isn't for you, hold on. And you have to really, really make room to allow women space when they're so used to being kind of shoved to the side. And men apparently have no shame about just, you know, throwing themselves to the front, even when it's clearly not really aimed at them.
Yeah, yeah. Yuna, for you, how often have you been the only woman in the room, or the obvious, like, the minority candidate in the room there?
You know, I don't think actually that often. Occasionally, but I feel like, especially in some of the types of wargaming I've been involved with, more of the geopolitical or, more of those, or more, you know, irregular warfare where there's area expertise. I feel like those are areas where professionally women do appear. So when they're brought into the game as participants, it is an extension of their expertise. So I know there's certain types of war games, especially at the technical or operational level, where the participants and the people who are specializing in that really reflect the fact that women don't operate in those spaces. But I think it's not been terrible. I think, though, that I would say even also, right, in not being assumed that you're the senior person because you're a woman, I would also have to say, sadly, that in a really multinational environment, if there are white women, I'm assumed to automatically be right beneath them as well. So I had one experience where it was a European sponsor that said, well, you know, can we put a European face on the game? They didn't mean, you know, high minorities, but they just meant not American, right? But our American team had me and another woman who's a minority. So we brought in a white woman who is a facilitator and European, right? So she was who went, she was who, you know, the people went to. And again, sort of like, even though I had sort of designed the thing, right, minority women were assumed to be, right, the help in a sense.
Yeah, the sidekicks.
Right.
That, Sally, you were going to jump in there or something.
I mean, I was just gobsmacked of the crass statement. But also, it's not just about being a woman. You know, I'm very often the only person in a room with a visible disability, and that can feel pretty isolating. And I mean, it's harder to tell who's gay and who's not by looking, but you can also feel kind of, you know, military is a very macho environment. There's definitely policing around what's masculine enough to count, and then doubly for women who have to be both masculine enough to seem competent but not too masculine, because if they're not feminine enough, then they're obviously a lesbian, or they're not, you know, playing the game right. So gender can spill over into not just women, and, you know, it's a really complicated space.
Rex, before we lose you, I want to bring you back into this, because in your classroom environments up there at McGill, you've talked in the past that you've got almost a 50-50 split in some of the classes where you're specifically using and promoting professional wargaming as a potential, you know, career track for people to head off into. So between them graduating from a program like yours, or, you know, the new one that Georgetown is standing up with some of the great things that some women are doing in that program, when they get their diploma and they head off to the working world, what happens to them that we end up with Yuna or Sally being like the rare woman in the professional space?
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, about half of my students in my conflict simulation design course are women, but that's because it's a social science course. So, you know, I'm not recruiting out of the hobby. I'm recruiting people who are interested in conflict and conflict resolution and so on and so forth. And then they're operating in a university space, which is, I think protects and respects diversity. I tend to argue that if people want careers in wargaming, they should become analysts first and who know how to wargame, as opposed to wargamers who then learn a subject. So I think that their ability to get into positions in the national security environment or related environments, I mean, the avenue is going to be that they're good analysts who happen to be able to deploy serious games in support support of their analysis. I think, though, as someone who's a bit protective about my students hitting the marketplace, for me, as someone who's not suffering from this kind of discrimination, what was important was to set down a professional principle, which I think, frankly, is widely shared amongst professional wargamers as a kind of benchmark. That, you know, if you're wargaming, there are expectations about diversity and inclusion, which are essentially professional standards. Now, you know, this is not the first statement to do this. Frankly, Connections UK has had a diversity statement on its webpage for a while now, for example. But I think we're just getting it out there that, you know, this is the standard. And in some ways, I was inspired. I don't know if you remember it. Back in 2013, the then Australian Army Chief, David Morrison, put out a video on sexism in the ranks in the Australian Army. And it is probably the best video that anyone in any military has ever put out in these things. And he said, you know, this is the standard you walked past is the standard you accept. And he laid it out very clearly what the professional expectation was in this case in the Australian Army about diversity, about inclusion, about respect, and so forth. I think we're kind of doing that in a way, or at least this was, you know, my motivation to be part of this was to say this is the professional standard. We work to make people feel included. We recognize the value of diversity. We recognize that there are all kinds of visible and invisible barriers, not just, you know, active discrimination, but all kinds of systemic factors as well. And that we're going to strive to address that and do better. And here's a bit of a touchstone of core, very basic, it's a very short statement, principle. So for me, you know, I'd like to think that my students, when they hit the job market, and a couple of them are now professional wargamers, I'd like to think that they're operating in a professional environment in which that is the accepted standard. Now, we've talked about the hobby. It's important to recognize that, you know, most people in the hobby aren't, you know, being actively misogynist or anything. But I've always been worried that when you do get actively bigoted statements coming out in online forums, 98% of everyone doesn't say anything. You know, that's almost as problematic as the statements in the first place. You know, we've got to get to a position where that kind of those kinds of positions are just not something we consider socially acceptable or professionally acceptable. So, and as I said, I'm going to have to disappear now, but I so far have been really pleased with the reaction we've received amongst professionals who overwhelmingly regard this as the right kind of thing that we should be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for jumping in. Appreciate you being here, even though it was a limited time. But I know you were one of the driving forces behind making these things go, and so we wanted to at least get your perspective on that part of it. So thanks again.
Okay. Bye-bye, guys.
See ya.
In terms of getting back to sort of some of the professional wargaming experiences with you guys, I've seen something kind of similar to what y'all are describing, and this actually goes back almost 10 years. I've talked some in some of the podcasts before about some of the work that I'd done with the National Defense University, and look, I wasn't designing or operating the game at the level that you guys are used to working for. We were the software guys that had built the software engine that was running the game itself. And that was for the Gemstone game that we did at the National Defense University now almost 10 years ago. I wasn't in the room with all of the players all of the time the way the NDU staff were. But I was struck by one specific difference between the two different years that we were there in the room with them. The first year, there was an Army Lieutenant Colonel male, white male, running the game. He was the guy that originally came to us and said, hey, we've got this thing, we want you to build this game for us. Here's the engine underneath it all. And so we worked with him. We got this thing built, had a ton of fun doing it. Turned out that, you know, they really got a lot out of the game. They felt like the students and faculty got a lot out of the game, and they wanted to bring us back the next year to do it. Well, he had left the NDU between the first year and the second year. In the second year, the person in charge was Ellie Bartels. Yuna, you know her really well. Sally, you probably know at least who Ellie is if you haven't met her in person.
I have not met her.
Okay, so Ellie was running things the next year, and like, Ellie's in charge of the game. We're doing the software support under her direction, but she's in charge of the game, and I'm the guy on site from the software team that's sitting in the white cell with everybody else. But, you know, I don't have to be glued to the computer the entire time. I'm getting up, walking around, seeing what's going on, asking some questions of the NDU staff to kind of better understand the things that are happening in the game. And again, I'm not completely oblivious to everything that's happening in the room, because I'm not just some stray hobby wargamer. Again, I spent 14 years in uniform. I've done wargame design in the hobby sense. I've done a lot of this stuff. So I'm learning from the NDU guys, but I'm not learning from those neophyte questions of, you know, sort of, so what's on the map exactly? Like, I know what's there. I put it there. But I was struck by how many folks, when they had an exercise question that year, didn't go ask Ellie. They went and found, like, Tim Wilkie or one of the guys on the staff and went and asked them what's going on, who would immediately turn around and go flag down Ellie or find Ellie and say, hey, tell us about what's happening here. It's possible that I just happen to only see the 10 times or 8 times or whatever that actually happened, and that it really wasn't as pervasive as it looked like to me. I suspect that's probably not the case.
Absolutely not the case. And I do know Ellie. I was on her dissertation committee. She's recently graduated, so it's now doctor. But yes, I will say this, though. It happens all the time. But the thing about the military is that it's hierarchical, so they will always have to call you doctor.
That's kind of fun to hear. So, look, she's earned it. She's absolutely deserved it. She wasn't when I knew her, so I keep forgetting to do that and call her Dr. Bartels, because she wasn't when I was working with her. But you're right, she absolutely is Dr. Bartels these days. The reason I'm hedging slightly here is because I don't want to speak for her. I don't want to speak for Tim. They were the ones that actually had to experience it. This is just me sort of sitting on the side, kind of observing some things that are happening. But again, like I said, I would suspect those aren't the only times that it happened. The only couple of times it happened were when I happened to be watching. I suspect that probably went on all week long.
Yeah, no, that's certainly my experience. And I write the software in support of war games, so I've worn your hat, but I had the opposite experience of you. And the other side to it is that unqualified men don't seem to have any problem answering questions that they don't know the answer to, and putting their two pennies worth in,
yeah,
and then not necessarily taking it so graciously when you're like, look, I know better, shut up.
Yeah, I've got this. I have frequently joked in the past around other topics, you know, hey, look, if I don't know the answer, I'll just make something up and we'll go with it. And in a casual context, in a hobby games context, like, you can pull that off, right? Because you're not basing national security policy on some flippant answer that some dude's giving at a game convention. But I can get away with that in that context. That's not the kind of thing you can get away with in a professional context. And so, you know, Sally, when you mention that sort of makes me cringe a little bit. That, like, there's people winging it, and we're, like, basing big real-world decisions on this.
And Brant, what you observed in that one game is so common that I wouldn't even think to mention it, because that's just the constant environment. You know, it's so common that, you know, that's the part where, like, you almost get used to it because it's just so pervasive. I don't know what to say. I will say that is one of the reasons we are launching the Women's Wargaming Network, and it's sad that Rex had to get off, because this is something that, talking to Tim Wilkie and Scott Chambers, organizing for Connections, we just thought of. So we are going to start a network where women have a space to be mentored by other women in wargaming, and just have a space where, you know, I have the website now reserved, and the tagline to the Women's Wargaming Network is going to be a mansplain-free zone.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but I mean, it does sound so totally appropriate.
Yes. I think I'll have to, when I tweet it out, I will have to tweet out. There's a great sort of graphic floating out there about, like, am I mansplaining or not? The flowchart. It's always a good reminder to everyone to see that.
Yeah,
I have that pinned up next to my desk at work. It's very good.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the answer is probably, and you just don't realize it. That's unfortunately seems to be what happens a lot. I want to ask you guys a couple of particular questions about some of the Derby House principles, because I think one of the questions that folks are going to have is sort of, how do we operationalize these things? Because there's some great ideas in here that I think most folks, a couple of toxic, you know, online environments being accepted here, but folks in the professional world, like Rex said, this is a bit of a no-brainer. Like, people understand these are good things to aspire to, particularly because we've seen better analysis, better outcomes when we have a wider group of folks involved in our professional gaming. The principles are written at a very high level, and so sort of what does it mean when we actually put them in place? And so one of them is saying, encouraging a greater role and higher profile for colleagues from underrepresented groups in our professional activities. And so what exactly does encouraging mean? Like, how do we actually put that into practice at an event, at an organization, at a conference, at a war game? Sally, where do you see that actually happening, and how would that get operationalized?
So over the last couple of weeks, there's been a huge cultural shift where I work and with people that I work with. Just people starting to finally realize, yeah, they're not just kind of, I'm sure it's not like that to me. They're starting to realize, maybe I don't have the only perspective in the room. Maybe I need to shut up and listen, or go and read a book, or, you know, so making space, that's part of what encouraging means. So one of the really good things about wargaming as a culture is that at its bones, it embraces all this stuff anyway. So reg teaming is all about taking another perspective. So if you're into that and you believe in, you know, thinking yourself inside the mind of the enemy, of course you need to expose yourself to all kinds of different perspectives that aren't your own. And, you know, this is no different to figuring out what the enemy tanks are going to do. It's figuring out the person who sits across you in a war game, what's their perspective on life, how is the behavior going on around them making their experience slightly different to yours.
Yeah.
And, you know, we use wargaming as a safe space to make mistakes and then learn by analysis. So, you know, it's fine to accidentally or inadvertently do something wrong as long as you're prepared to listen when someone says, actually, that's not so cool. Can you do it a bit differently next time? And experiential learning is just so good for building understanding. So there's a great webpage made by Nikki Case, The Parable of the Polygons, and it's all about squares and triangles that are nice overall, but a little bit shapist, and they don't like to be too cut off from other shapes that look like them. And it's such a beautiful explanation of how whenever you've had a system where there's bias, it's not enough to just say, right, we don't do bias anymore. You have to take an active step to encourage back in all the diversity that you kind of pushed away. So it's just, you know, making space for people that haven't been able to take up their seat at the table as easily as you have.
When someone comes back with the counter of, clearly you're talking about implementing a quota system, what's the, Yuna, how would you counter that argument?
I think sometimes I have heard complaints from white men that this like diversity or things, you know, the suggestion is that unqualified people will like get jobs. And I'm like, do you have any idea how much more qualified and talented I have to be than white men at every single job that I hold, right? So at a previous analyst job for the Marine Corps, right? Like, I have to have 5 degrees, have double majored at MIT, have taken calculus when I was 14 years old, have a PhD, right? Be like an expert in my field. To have the whole same job as a white male who had a local university degree, and that's it, right? But I'm the one who, when I onboard, and we have like a big hail and farewell where, you know, the organization gets together and the sort of senior executive sort of openly questions whether or not I'm the person qualified for the job, right? So that, I've always been sort of impatient with that. But I do also want to talk about, like, how do you operationalize those principles? And a very easy way is to see, do I have a mantle, right? A mantle is an all-male panel. So check, are the speakers only all men, right? There's Mantle Watch on Twitter. Last year, I think some outside group looked at all of the Washington, D.C. area think tanks and then scored them on what percentage of the speakers in foreign policy were women. I think Rand came in at over 50% of their speakers were women. And I think CSBA came in at the lowest in the group at like 15%. But right, are women actually portrayed, given a chance to speak as experts or just moderators, right? Because if they're only moderators, it fits into this idea that women are gracious hosts but aren't actually experts on the topic. So first of all, who do you have up on their speaking? And I think one thing that RAND really did that I appreciate is they had the Rebecca Wallstetter Forum, and then they didn't tell anyone ahead of time that it was going to be just all women, right? To just, right, but that also questions whether or not, why are we used to such all male spaces? So someone told me one, and I got a chance to speak in that forum, and then someone exiting told me they heard one of the people had come saying, you know, if anyone says they can't find a woman to speak on these topics, they're either lazy or they're lying.
Yeah.
So there's that. And also to even challenge it when you see a manual, when you see a conference that the lineup is just all white and male, right? I think I was part of this one discussion group, informal discussion group. And I said, hey, I've been coming to this group for like 3 years. Do you actually ever have women speakers? Because I've never seen one in 3 years. So then there's like defensiveness, and then like they pull out the names of women that they had like years ago, right? So it's
It's moral licensing. You know, we had one woman, so we've done that now. Move on.
Right, and you know, sort of what is it? The stages of grief, right? Denial, anger, you know, depression, acceptance, right?
Yes, bargaining is in there somewhere.
Yes, bargaining. Yeah, we had a woman like 3 years ago, right? Like, but then you push that, and then they panic, and then they go, well, we need some women. Like, could you, like, do something? Like, so they give you the hard sell so they can fix this problem, quote unquote. But you have to do that, and then you have to take that chance so that other people go, hey, you know, I saw a woman. She said competent things, right? So you have to do baby steps.
Yeah. And now you're expected to be the savior.
I also say sadly sometimes the focus on women in wargaming or getting women into really any male dominated area focuses, like, all the excitement is about, then it goes to sort of white women. So it's really sad to see when the focus is on the cute white women, and then that you see women who are Asian or African-American, and then Latinas don't even make it into the national security space, right, in the United States. Like, they're left out of the women wargaming event, right? It's literally only the white women, and that is really sad and frustrating to see. It's really sad and frustrating for me to hear from Black colleagues that they wish that they could get into wargaming for years, but they haven't been able to, or if they can, they're just given fewer opportunities. So another way to actually operationalize it is, do you actually include and mentor people who are not white? And I would say in the defense area, I think you can be sort of non-white, like a guy, or you can be a woman and white and still sort of make it, not as high. But I think if you have both, you're just not going to make it to the higher echelons.
Yeah. Sally, comparable experience over there in the UK?
Oh, we certainly do women's representation in wargaming better than any kind of non-white representation. So, yeah, that's a huge problem. And I think a lot of it has to do with this idea of what the mainstream is interested in or should be interested in. So, you know, when a man speaks, he speaks for all of humanity, and when a woman speaks, it's women's interest. And there's a really good example recently. So we do a lunchtime historical lecture series where some of our military historians will go back through significant military actions, and it'll all be about, you know, how there are parallels with the current situation, the lessons that we can learn from that kind of stuff. And we had a special one for Gay History Month where we did queeros, and we had LGBT and gender non-conforming figures in military history. And so normally the historical lectures is standing room only in the lecture hall. And for this one, literally only queer people showed up. And it's like all of these straight people are saying that there's nothing they can learn from queer military figures. And, you know, for one, that's wrong, because there have been gay people with significant influence on pretty much every major military action since forever, you know, like Kitchener and Churchill. So plenty of important figures are interesting to the mainstream community as long as they assume that it kind of fits in their box. And as soon as you call it gay or black or woman, it becomes a niche interest. And part of that whole red teaming focus of wargaming should be seeking out that kind of diversity of experience. So, you know, if you want to operationalize these principles, if you're a straight white man, you need to go and sit in these other rooms that you assumed are not for you and get some of that perspective.
I know we've talked for the majority of this call so far on this episode about sort of the male-female split, but, you know, that wasn't the intent. And so you mentioning sort of the gender non-conforming people, not bringing them up until now was not kind of an intentional thing. It's just we've got a pair of women who work in the main space, you know, in that national security space, and that's kind of where we've sort of lived with most of this conversation, although, you know, you've mentioned some of the racial minority piece as well. It wasn't intentional to like blow it off until the 40-minute mark. So thank you for bringing that up and you know, making sure that we include that. I want to ask you real quick about the racial piece relative to the UK. I've spent a little bit of time in England. I've got some friends from England, but not. I don't know England to the level of intimacy that I know Germany from having lived there.
Wait, you're saying I know English people?
my wife is a dual citizen. So you know, and you know, my boss at the soccer facility where I moonlight is British, and I've got it's one of those things where if I started listing all of the English folks that I know, we're going to need multiple pages of multiple notebooks. It's one of those things that I'm not the stray American dude who had a drink with a random English guy in a bar once and goes, I know English folks. You know, again, I'm married to a dual citizen. but I know Germany far more intimately than I know England. And I know one of the issues that I always ran into in Germany dealing with issues of sort of racial minorities, racial harmony is a lot of Germans would sort of stick their heads in the sand about their behavior towards other races, especially when talking to Americans, with the attitude of, we don't need to be told how to treat races equally because you guys are the ones that needed a war to get rid of slavery. You guys are the ones that needed a civil rights movement to get rid of Jim Crow. You're the ones that still have issues with racial disparity in the U.S. Don't come talk to us about how we treat racial minorities. And I'm looking at them going, I just watched you use like 14 slurs towards the Turkish folks here in the school. Like, what gives? Do you think some of the racial attitudes in England versus the U.S. are an issue of different experiences over time, different percentages of populations, different levels of involvement where you happen to be within the professional world? Any idea what that might be that's contributing towards what you're seeing with the way racial minorities get treated in the national security space as opposed to just a gender difference?
So, I mean, not being a minority, I obviously can't speak for their experience, and I wouldn't want to. I think the difference between the UK and US is... I mean, your police are more aggressive. That's not to say that there isn't a racial bias in our policing. I think the UK has to consider its colonial past, and you know, the Industrial Revolution was funded by the slave trade, and that's not a lesson that's taught in UK schools. So I think if you grow up white and middle class, it's very easy to think that Britain doesn't have a racial problem, and that if you're in the minorities, it can look different. So a lot of the lack of racial diversity in wargaming comes from, you know, we're drawn from the civil service and branches of the military that tend to pull their people from grammar schools and public schools and places that are historically not welcoming to people who aren't white. And that doesn't mean that people are necessarily racist. It's just that they've grown up in these situations where it's not been easy for minority people to get a foot in the door. And then you just kind of go along with that. You don't take that step to say, well, there's no diversity here. I need there to be diversity and change the system. It's easier to sit back and just let it carry on as it is.
And when you're talking about need to change the system, obviously there's the system in which you're operating in terms of that professional wargaming system of here's where I go bring people into my profession. But it almost sounds like some of that system that you're thinking needs to be sort of kicked in the tail a little bit is at the echelons well below that where you're even recruiting people into that professional world. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that kind of where you're going with that?
Yeah, very much so. You know, there's particular universities in the UK that are more prestigious, and overwhelmingly that's not where racial minorities go. So immediately you're excluding. So like Oxford's quite proud of its recently not so terrible statistics on black and minority students. Almost all of them are overseas students, so immediately they can't apply to work for the government work that's British nationals only. So a university can appear to be much more diverse than the talent pool that is available.
Yeah,
in that sense.
Yeah. You know, compare contrast with what you've seen sort of in that professional space here in the U.S.
I think, first of all, it's much easier to see the flaws in someone else than to recognize your own flaws, especially if it's so part of the background you don't actually question it, right? So it's always easier to see how someone else is treating their minorities, how someone else is treating their women, because you don't have buy-in into the system. You are actually a little bit more neutral and a little bit more objective, and it's much harder to look at what you're part of and what you may actually be benefiting from. So on the whole, how far does it start? So in national security, you have very, in the United States system, because it's a much larger ecosystem, the national security environment, than it is for, I think, most other countries, just because of the size of the U.S. military, right? There are a lot of places where different groups are sort of dominant, right? You have, in the enlisted side, a lot of African-American and Latino. On the officer side, it's predominantly nearly all white male. In some of the... but, you know, so I think once I was complaining to someone who was... you know, black, I go, man, they keep putting me on the stamp track because I'm Asian, right? And he looks at me and goes, at least you get to be on the stamp track, right? And if you want to talk about how early this sort of disparities start. So right now, I went to a magnet science and tech high school, and which is now, I think, like 75% Asian. But then the tracking for that, tracking to get on that starts at about age 7. And that's where we see racial disparities already in who gets selected for the gifted and talented, or now it's renamed something else, programs. New York City, right, starts at age 4 and has had to grapple with a very segregated school system where certain groups, right, like white and Asian, get on the track for the higher, sort of the gifted or the advanced or the accelerated. And other people are just simply not on the track. So, like, from age 4, we start to see the divergence. So this is a real, much harder systemic problem. And I do appreciate by the time you get to the right end of the pipeline, you're like, well, what can someone who is just at that end of the pipeline do in terms of increasing diversity if there just aren't a lot of people that they can try to even encourage or like include? And I think that's why we all have to do what we can, but from as early on as we can, because of how early these disparities start.
Yeah, that age 4 just seems bat crap crazy to me. I can't wrap my head around that one. I just I can't do it. I'm going to punt on that. What the hell? Like, that seems nuts.
I mean, you see the same kind of thing going on with people that have disabilities, and just the way that not conforming to the right standards in the classroom just gets you put in a corner, and all of the opportunities where you could show that, okay, I'm not good at spelling, but I can do all these other things, they're withheld from you until you can do this low-level task that, you know, you're never going to master to their expectations. So why not use technology and sidestep that? But that's not how schools think. So then whole generations of kids that have got so much potential just get told over and over again, there's nothing good you can do here, go away. And I think the same thing's happening to people in the same way, like black kids are socialized differently and policed differently in the classroom. You know, you can, like, a boy can be loud and talkative, and that's, he's engaged in the lesson. If a girl does that, she's being disruptive. And if a black girl does that, it's like through the roof disruptive. And, you know, so many small barriers that people can just change by their attitude instead of ripping up the whole system and starting again.
And absolutely, I really want to also, you know, absolutely underscore that point about people with disabilities, because both my kids have disabilities, and I gotta tell you, I have to go in guns a blazing sometimes to the school system.
Yeah, I've had just, you know, I live in terror of my reasonable adjustments getting undone by the latest software update, because it's so hard to convince people that I'm not joking. And, yeah, you know, they see someone with a disability who's succeeding, and they kind of forget, or they think, oh, it can't be that much. Like, you can see a Paralympian run a 10-second 100 metres and forget that, you know, day-to-day, they're still missing a leg. It doesn't grow back when they leave the racetrack.
Yeah, and
people can be remarkably dumb about disability.
Yeah, plus you end up with the assumption of, well, they succeeded, so how bad can that disability really be?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I get that all the time.
Yeah.
And the pressure to prove that you're worth the extra effort, and the feeling of being constantly watched. You know, if you screw up, it's because you were never capable, rather than, you know, I made a mistake. Guys get to make mistakes all the time. And, you know, it's that men are presumed competent until they prove otherwise, but women and minorities have to constantly prove that they're competent.
Yeah, it's that difference in the one mistake versus the, you know, when the standard is perfection, like, one mistake can be fatal, but when the standard isn't perfection, you can get away with multiple mistakes. You know?
Yeah, and just, you know, understanding that, you know, most things in life aren't performance art. It doesn't have to be right the first time. You can kind of steer onto the situation that you want it to be, but so often there are so few opportunities for minority people that they have to succeed the first time. There's no room for a kind of 90%. You have to be 100% or 110% to get that second chance.
We're approaching an hour on this podcast here as we're recording it. By the time I'm done editing, we may lose a couple minutes here and there where I remove myself saying a few too many times. But I did want to circle back around to some of the Darby House principles and sort of putting some of these things in action. And with, you know, again, I don't want to sound like we're just projecting everything on to the two of you to sort of solve all of these problems. But for folks like me, look, I am the classic stereotype wargamer, right? I tick all of the appropriate boxes. I'm a middle-aged white dude with a, you know, a middle-aged white guy, overeducated, under-challenged throughout school, you know, some military background, deep abiding experience in history and military history. So I managed to check all of those stereotype boxes along the way. For folks like me, when you're talking to guys like me and we look at some of those Darby House principles, what's some of the advice that you would give us for things that we should be able to do, things that we should be paying attention to, things that we should be more conscious of as we start looking at trying to put those Darby House principles into action and get those more inclusive voices into the things we're doing. And I'm saying that with the full caveat of I don't work in the professional wargaming space, right? I talk with a lot of folks about it. I help, you know, draw awareness to it, but I'm not in that space at this point in my life. I've been there before. I'm not there now. But I suspect even some of the things you guys will have to say probably apply in the hobby space as well. Yuna, you want to take a first crack at this? What are some of the things that we should be paying attention to?
First of all, absolutely do not underestimate your own ability to impact the system. Right? You're saying you're typical white male gamer, right? But that's who all my mentors were, right? Like people like Rex and people like Ed McGrady and people like Peter Perla and people like Tim Wilkie. They kept insisting I belonged in the professional wargaming crowd when I was like, what is this with, like, the dice? Like, what are you guys doing here? Like, these are grown men with dice. Like, they kept insisting I belonged, right? And event, you know, and so that gave me an opportunity, that, you know. So, right, all of us, you know, entering in, like, a very white male-dominated space. Well, white men decided that we should be given an opportunity, that we should be mentored, that we should be supported, and they did, and that's why we're here. So do not underestimate your own power.
Yeah, I'd second that.
Going back to the Zumba class example from 45 minutes ago at this point, one of the things that somebody had brought up in a conversation that I was having around that is, it's one thing to see somebody who may be visibly an outsider to that traditional community, who is a woman, who is a minority, who has a disability, who whatever box you want to check along the way, that isn't that middle-aged white guy stereotype. But it's one thing to say, you know, to not denigrate them when they come to the table, to not be a jerk, to not be an asshat, right? I mean, those are just basic human expectations that you want out of folks sitting around the table. The presumption of competence, I think, you know, we're still having to beat a few people over the head with that, but don't assume the person sitting around the table is incompetent. But is it overly patronizing? Is it overly solicitous to, hey, hope you had a great time. Please come back and see us another time. Please come back and join us the next time we're doing this. Please, you know, don't be afraid to come get involved. Do you need that extra step of invitation towards inclusiveness that you might not feel the need to give otherwise? Sally, is that something that would come across as warranted and accepted, or is that something that seems sort of overly pushy?
Well, I guess, you know, if that's how you behave to your wife or your daughter or your sister or your mother, you know, why wouldn't you behave that way to someone else? Or, you know, if you wouldn't like that done to people you love, stand up and say, please stop. One of the things we've done with the Derby House Principles is that D20 diversity icon, we're having enamel pins made. And people that are in that silent majority who think this is cool but don't know how to speak up, or don't, you know, some people feel uncomfortable or not confident about standing up and saying, hey, we welcome diversity here, they can wear that pin, and you can walk into a room and you can see that you're welcome. And for my personal experience, it is really good if you go into a room to brief senior people, or you go to a conference or something, and you see ally pins, you know that people are welcoming without having to kind of wave flags and maybe get into that uncomfortable patronizing space. And you can immediately identify which parts of the room you should go for and which parts maybe you should stay away from, because you don't know what response you're going to get.
Yeah, fair statement there. Yuna, thoughts on this one?
So if the professional wargaming community is a community of practice, so if you look at the literature on communities of practice, and they do have life cycles, right? So wargaming is a community of practice. It's not a community of interest, right? Like golden retriever dog lovers might be a community of interest, right? Where you share just dogs of your cute golden retriever with each other. But wargaming, like, you learn from each other, right? And then one of the hallmarks of a successful community of practice is you feel comfortable enough where you call someone up and go, hey, how did you, like, handle this type of cyber game, right? Or hey, how did you do this kind of information aspect in this game? And you so communities of practice, sometimes a lot of the knowledge is informal or tacit, they do oftentimes go through periods where they might formalize some of the knowledge. But because that is so central to the practice of being a wargamer, I think making and then the communities of practice literature talk about identities, right? So anything that helps people identify with the wargaming community, right, is going to make them a better wargamer because it gives them access and resources to the community of practice. So I say, yeah, like, you know, I think, like, if you're going to, you know, explain to me, you know, if you're going to mansplain, that's one thing. But if you're just going to be welcoming, I think that can be very beneficial, especially if someone is a wargamer already in this space. That opens the door to someone feeling comfortable with you and then going, hey, asking you a question later, right? And then that brings someone into this community of practice and the identity as a wargamer. So I'm absolutely all for it.
Now, especially because you've been one of the lightning rods out there a little bit in the social space for the hobby wargamers. Same rules, similar rules? How might you adjust some of those thoughts and principles for folks that exist? Look, the majority of our audience is in the hobby wargaming space. We'll probably get some extra folks in the professional space listening to this episode because of the two of you being on here. But that's not the core of our audience. The core of our audience are those hobby wargame guys that you know, are interested in, oh, hey, what are the pros doing with our stuff? How might you look to apply? Because that's not a community of practice, right? That's more of that community of interest that you were talking about. How might you apply a similar thing in that space, Yuna?
I would say if you are concerned about where some of the social media could go, and I know that some people are saying, well, they just can't control in a very large group what everyone posts. If your moderators are only men and they're the ones lecturing women and saying, well, your complaint isn't valid because I don't find it sexist, you know, like, think about that, right? Could you have some women moderators? You can't find any women in hobby wargaming to moderate, and if there's a question of whether or not it's sexist, oh, if a woman feels it's sexist, she could at least have a chance to make a case to another woman who's the moderator. Or even small things like that, I think, would make a difference.
So when are you signing up to join us at the Armchair Dragoon so I can recruit you to be a moderator?
After I get the Women's Wargaming Network set up.
All right.
How's that?
To be fair, like, we only have three moderators because our audience, our registered audience at our forums hasn't even hit 200 yet. So maybe we'll pick up a couple of more as we go here along the way. We've intentionally sort of been a little more slow growth on the things we've done, and we've ejected a couple of people for being jerks. Fortunately, we haven't had to do too many because our members are remarkably self-moderating in their behavior, which has been nice so far.
One suggestion, rather than remove offensive posts, you might take a screenshot and explain to everyone else exactly why it's inappropriate.
So, by and large, we have done that in the past. In one particular case, when the member left, that member nuked his posts, and so we didn't get a chance to get the screenshot beforehand. Should have. But in the past, in other places that I've moderated, I've quote posted line by line exactly what the problems were. Look, don't do this, don't do this, don't say this, you're being a twerp. I've been very detailed in some of the things that I've taken people apart for.
You shouldn't underestimate the power that you have saying that as the straight white man, in a way that the minority person saying the same isn't listened to. So yeah, it's really important for you to do that ally thing, even if you feel like, you know, you're kind of screaming against the void somewhat. It's really powerful for the minorities to see that it's not just us sticking up for ourselves, it's the a part of the community too. And although the Derby House thing is professional wargaming, and we've been talking about it at my work in a professional capacity, what's been really, really gratifying about it is the overwhelming response from the hobby gamers who also happen to work where I work. So they're not the professional wargamers, but, you know, the overwhelming majority of the response so far has been from hobby gamers saying, this is amazing, I want this, I want to wear one of those pins when I play D&D and when I go to a games conference and things like that. So there's a danger that in talking about the trolls who are vile, we forget that 99% of the hobby gaming community are decent human beings, and they think diversity is good, and they don't want these nasty people cluttering up their hobby.
And I think that's something that's come up in multiple discussions that we've had around. So, you know, again, for first-time listeners who may not be aware, the Armchair Dragoons, we are primarily an online community, sort of a strategy gaming magazine and discussion area online. But we do real-world events. We've run the wargaming program at Origins for a couple of years under a couple of different hats. But we've done real-world events in a lot of places. There's been once or twice in the past where we've had to kick people out of games for being a jerk. It hasn't happened very often. Fortunately, when folks start acting like jerks, our guys have no problem telling folks to chill out, you're being a jerk, cut it out, and the behavior is corrected at that point and it moves forward. We haven't seemed to have many issues with that in the past. One of the things, you know, again, both of you have spoken extensively about your experiences as women in wargaming, and by and large, I don't know that we've had a ton of, I won't say I don't know, because I haven't talked to the people that don't play games with us, but the women that we've had come play in our events in the real world, we've had a bunch of them come back multiple times. I mean, we've got one pair, a man and woman, who the first time they came to play with us at Origins, they were just boyfriend-girlfriend. The next summer they were engaged. The next summer they were married. And they came back every year. They wanted to come play. And it was her dragging him to come play. And that was really cool to see, that we've had women that have been able to come play. One of the things that I have noticed, just thinking back over the groups of folks that we've had play with us, we haven't had a ton of racial representation in our events. And I don't know if that's an issue of lack of interest, because again, these are self-selected audiences. You have to sign up for the event to be there. If that's a genuine lack of interest, or folks just not at Origins who, you know, racial minorities not at Origins who would be interested in our games, or if they're looking at the group at our booth and seeing it's really pale and feeling uncomfortable about approaching us to join. And so it's one of those things that I'm planning on sort of mulling over a little bit. How do we try and make ourselves as welcoming as possible for folks that may want to come play? And if they still don't want to come play, like, I'm not going to go, you know, I'm not going to go herd them towards us and, you know, like, force them to come play. That's not what we're about. But I don't want anybody looking at the crowd and going, that's not, that doesn't look like a place for me. I don't want that to happen. So it's something that all of this has made me have to think about a lot harder for how do I get these people involved.
Some of it's having games that have diverse content. So when you're playing miniature games, are there female characters? And are they females that aren't, you know, made with the male gaze in mind? Do they look like normal women? And are there black characters? And are there black women where it's not, ooh, exotic, nasty, kind of exploitation kind of stuff? So if people see games that reflect who they are, they will be more likely to join in. And so, the same with disabled people.
So in the case of some of the things we're doing, I'm not sure how appropriate it would be to put those in some of the games without it being sort of ahistorical tokenism. And I want to explain briefly, sort of, for a bunch of years, we ran big event games for the Lost Battalion Games Sergeants series. And it was one of the few minis things that we did where we had miniatures run around the table, and it was a 1-to-1 ratio. It was one figure represents one person. But it was squad-level combat in World War II. And no offense, there just weren't a lot of women running around in infantry squads in World War II on either the Allied or the German side. So
that's true, but then who says it has to be accurate in all ways?
You
could have a woman infantry in the game because it's your game, your rules.
To an extent, but if the manufacturer doesn't even make those things, how do I put that in there? Like, if I don't even have that option from the manufacturer.
And you get some of their marvelous female infantry units.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, just trying to, in my mind, picture sort of what all those figures were. And I'll be honest, I don't remember if there were any racial minorities in any of the figures. None of them stick out. I know there weren't any women running around in there. Again, we're not doing fantasy wargaming. We're not doing role-playing stuff. So we don't have the chainmail bikini on the table. Like, that's totally outside the scope of what we do. That's not even relevant for us. But the idea of what do we do for the World War II units, do we go ahead and stick a woman in there? Maybe that's something we look at. Maybe that's something we consider.
Yeah, and there's also a lot of historical precedent for women in these roles, for real.
Yeah.
So researching WATU, the number of times I've come across, well, actually, there were women enlisted in the Royal Navy in World War II as officers, not Wrens. So for in the UK, we had the Royal Navy men and then the Wrens Women's Royal Navy Voluntary Service were a separate organization. But there were a dozen women that were in the Royal Navy as medical officers, and then a bunch of the Wrens that were doing operational duty, you know, standing watch on destroyers in the middle of the Mediterranean in 1943, things like that.
Wow.
And people don't think it happened because they haven't read about it. And that's only because men tell the stories and men decide what's interesting. And when you dig a little harder, there are women everywhere. So there's plenty of room to make games much more inclusive than they are.
So at the individual level, absolutely, I think there's definitely some steps we need to look at there. I think looking at the next couple of echelons up, though, if I've got counters that are moving tank battalions around on the battlefield, or if I've got Waterloo on the table and I've got, you know, the old guard is represented by these four counters, like where would you try to incorporate something like that without then turning around and having somebody yelling at you about how ahistorical you're being because there weren't female commanders at the Battle of Waterloo? And I'm just, it's one of those double-edged swords of you want to be able to be inclusive, but you also don't want to get yelled at for, you know, messing with history. And so maybe it's finding those historical stories that were representative and figuring out a good way to get those in place.
Yeah, and on the flip side, when you're playing games that aren't gendered, just losing all that gendered language. I mean, Rex is always pulling me up when we're playing with pawns that are obviously asexual things. I'll just, you know, accidentally, not thinking, refer to it as he, put him there. And it's like, it doesn't have to be a guy. And everybody does it. And the more we think about not doing it, the more we'll start questioning, why is it always men everywhere?
Yeah, and I think that's something that is probably happens a lot more in war games than people realize, is that you point to a counter and you say that guy there, even though that guy is a tank battalion, you know, or an aviation battalion that probably has a bunch of female pilots running around. It doesn't have to be that guy. It's those guys. It's those people. It's them. So that's a good point. That's a good point. And you see, those are the kinds of questions that, again, how do you operationalize this in what you're actually doing in a game somewhere? You know, how do you actually, when the rubber meets the road, how do you put this in place somewhere?
I mean, you just think a little bit harder, and it makes everything so much more inclusive for transgender people if we're not aggressively gendering things when we don't need to. So that when they say, you know, can you use they, or these are my pronouns, it doesn't become this whole issue of they're the only people doing it. So by not saying everything's male until you say otherwise, it makes the space more open for other people.
Yeah, I don't know as we've ever had an issue with somebody not respecting someone's pronouns at the interpersonal level. The point you're making about what you project onto the map, I think, is a fair point and something that, you know, probably needs some people to look at a little bit.
I appreciate the difficulty of that problem, though, right? Because, like, watching, for example, The Hobbit, right? The movies that came out of The Hobbit, I'm like, but there weren't any female characters in the book, right? And then, then try to put it in a way that I thought was, like, kind of clumsy. And even the original Lord of the Rings, I tried to make Arwen, like, Xena warrior princess. And you're like, but she wasn't Xena warrior princess. And there was nothing wrong with just, like, who she was. So I think I appreciate the trickiness of it, and perhaps it's if you want to introduce, right, this maybe gets to, maybe there should be a greater array of games to choose from, but if to avoid sort of clumsily adding in characters to try to do representation, you might want to have someone from the group actually be involved. I know that there have been books that I have stopped reading because the white male author was going to introduce, like, this Asian woman spy, and it's like, I just don't want to see how he's going to write this, because I've seen it before, and it's just, I have to put the book down because it's just like fingernails on a chalkboard. So you might want to have someone, I'm saying, involved in doing that.
Yeah, it's like every possible stereotype out there, so, you know.
Exactly.
And I think, unfortunately, for a lot of folks, the stereotype is like the only representation they know because of a lack of diversity among their friends group. Like, they don't know any better because they don't know anybody like that. And it's unfortunate, but I think that might be a lot of the problem for some people. So, We're well past the hour that I'd asked you guys to give up from your day, and I appreciate y'all sticking around a little longer. We're also about, as we're recording this, 7 minutes from kickoff of watching Newcastle get their butts handed to them from Man City. So I need to go start drinking now in order to be able to deal with this. I'm an avid Newcastle fan, which means that weekends tend to need to involve some imbibing to survive what they inflict on me on a regular basis. As a last wrap up here, Una, do you have any final thoughts you want to leave this with?
Thank you so much for even creating the space to have this conversation. It's very much appreciated.
Thank you for being able to it's always painful when you're the guy trying to figure out how to have these conversations, because you want to bring in smart folks to talk about them, but you don't want it to seem like, you know, hey, I need you to come in here and represent all of womanhood or all of the Asian wargamers or all of whatever. And it's tricky because you don't want to project that burden on you and, like, make you have to carry that. But, like, I don't know who else to call. And that's a failing on me. But, you know, like, who else do I go get? And so...
It's okay. The other Asian wargamer is fine with me speaking for him.
That, are you talking about the guy over at NDU, or is there somebody else that we need to know about? So...
At Georgetown, but okay. I won't out him.
I have a feeling he's on deck for joining us on the podcast in the fall anyway, so we may get both of you. Sally, any final thoughts?
I'd second that whole thanks for having us, making room for the conversation. And you know, don't be afraid of asking the wrong question if it's well intended. People get when it's a stupid thing to have said because you were trying to offend someone, versus when you're desperately trying to do it right and you don't want to put your foot in it. And, you know, they'll be helpful and appreciate that you're trying to take the effort.
Given how often I'm known for asking the wrong question, let's hope people can tell the difference, because there's plenty of volume to wade through on those. So... I appreciate y'all having some patience with me on this one. Ladies, thank you both. We'll thank Rex in absentia. I hope the zombie apocalypse is going well, wherever he is playing right now. And
I will shortly find out.
Yeah. And audience, I hope you've at least had the opportunity to think and reflect on some of the things we've discussed here, whether it's something you end up trying to put into practice yourself, or even if you just throw your hands up and go, these guys are nuts, at least you've taken the time to hear us out, and we appreciate that. I do hope that folks take the advice of these ladies to heart and pay a little more attention to the kinds of things you're doing, especially in a professional sense, in a professional setting where livelihoods can be at stake, where important decisions get made. You know, again, we're not talking a couple of folks sitting around a table with some beer and pretzels on a weekend pushing counters around, but you know, where, again, real important decisions get made. I think these voices are important and they matter, and I hope the audience takes something away from that around all that. So thank you guys. Goodbye, and I think we'll call it good here. And one of these days I'm going to call y'all back just to come talk about the games you play and the fun you have doing it.